Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Radwan Ziyadeh, who is an important member of the Syrian opposition. Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Radwan Ziyadeh, who is an important member of the Syrian opposition, and we will discuss the Arab League's imposition of sanctions on the Assad regime following the League's recent ejection from Syria from the organization of which Syria was a founding member. As the portent of civil war looms, we will discuss what actions the UN should take to stop the slaughter. Then we'll look into the latest source of tension between the US and Pakistan following a NATO airstrike that killed 24 Pakistani soldiers. Marvin Weinbaum joins us. He was a former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the State Department, and we will discuss the growing tensions between the erstwhile allies that could get out of hand as the US tries to exit from Afghanistan. Then finally, we'll have a discussion on the upcoming eviction of the Occupy Los Angeles encampment at City Hall, scheduled for midnight Sunday. Clark Davis, the media coordinator for Occupy LA, joins us in the studio, along with our other guests, Councilman Bill Rosendahl and Tom Hayden. We will discuss what looks like an impending clash between police and protesters and how it can be avoided. And joining us now is Radwan Ziyadeh, who is the founder and director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies. He's also a visiting scholar at the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University and a visiting fellow at Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. He also co-founded and directed the Syrian Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C. Previously, he was the editor-in-chief of Tirat magazine and secretary of the Syrian Organization for Transparency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Radwan Ziyadeh.
Thank you for having me.
And clearly, the Arab League adopting sanctions against Syria, since Syria was a founding member of the Arab League, I take it that that has got to be a profound, have a profound impact on the Syrian people. I'm not sure about the government. Tell me what you think is the reaction in Syria.
I think it's significant to see that first the Arab League suspends Syria membership from the Arab League since Syria is a founding member in the Arab League, and also puts different sanctions, economic sanctions and political sanctions regarding a travel ban of the senior Syrian officials from traveling. This is significant and hope that will put the end of the killings. But it's clear that today at least 36 has been killed, and there is no indication that the Assad regime will receive the message, will understand the message. This is why we would prefer that if the Arab League refer the case to protect the civilians to the Security Council. Would that allow the Security Council to take significant actions towards the Assad regime and to put the end of the brutality of the Assad militia?
Well, the reason, I suppose, it's not going to the UN, or at least if it does go to the UN, surely China and Russia will veto it. They're suggesting that they've seen this before with Libya, and they don't want this same mechanism being used as an excuse to escalate the situation in Syria into an all-out war, as happened in Libya.
It's actually Russia and China, they both practiced the veto because it wasn't such kind of Arabic support. Now there is a significant support of the decision of the Arab League. 19 member states, they support the decision of the Arab League to suspend Syria membership and to put sanctions on the Assad regime. And this is why if the Arab League officially referred the case to the Security Council, will that weaken the Russian and the Chinese position and make very difficult also for Russia, for India, Brazil, and South Africa to abstain? Because this is actually not only the decision of Europe and United States, rather than an official request from the Arab League, from the regional organization. Would that make the decision much more stronger?
And Radwan Ziyadeh, What about the sanctions with the Syrian central bank? Of course, there's also a freeze of assets on Assad's government, a travel ban on senior Syrian officials. But I would think that cutting off transactions with the Syrian central bank will have a pretty profound effect. There are already sanctions in place, are there not?
The sanctions which actually adopted by the Arab League, it will have significant impact on the Syrian economy. The Assad regime rely on the asset they have in some Arabic countries, and basically from United Arab Emirates and maybe Kuwait. If those countries actually stop any transfer to Syria and freeze the assets of the senior Syrian officials in those two countries, that will actually prevent some Syrian officials from using this money to fund what we call in Syria Shabiha or the attacks of the Assad militias. But again, that will not put the end of the Assad attack on the civilians. The only thing that it has to protect the civilians, to go to the Security Council, to put all the necessary measures of the Security Council to protect the civilians.
Well, clearly, the Syrian regime would not allow monitors in. A part of the reason why the Syria was kicked out of the Arab League and now these sanctions have been imposed is because Syria refused to allow 4,000 Arab League monitors into the country. Clearly, they do not want the world seeing what they're doing to their own people. Give us a sense.
Not only they refuse actually the Arab monitors, but also they refuse the fact-finding missions, the Commission of Inquiries, which actually adopted by the UN Human Rights Council. It's clear that the Assad regime wants to hide all the crimes against the humanity, all the war crimes that had Bashar al-Assad committed against his own people. This is why it's the time for the Security Council to take action. We should not allow for more killings, more atrocities to take in Syria. The United Nations actually intervened in Kenya after 1,000, in Cote d'Ivoire after 1,200. In Syria, the official number of the UN is 3,500. And this is why we don't understand why the international community is still reluctant or hesitant to take the necessary actions to protect the Syrian lives.
Again, I'm speaking with Radwan Ziadeh, who's the founder of and director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies, also a visiting scholar at the Kaas Center for Human Rights at Harvard University. And in terms of the Arab League vote, you mentioned that 19 Arab states voted in favor of the sanctions. But three votes were against it. I believe that was what, Iraq and Lebanon, and what was the third one?
It's actually Iraq. They abstained.
Abstained.
Lebanon.
Right.
They voted against.
Right.
And Yemen.
Yemen. I see. So would that mean then that the Assads could get money through Beirut, through Lebanon?
This is, we should actually, that Lebanon respect the decisions of the Arab League.
Mm-hmm.
More general, that also Yemen now, the change, the regime in Yemen, we have now a new prime minister and new president, and they shouldn't support the Assad anymore. This is why maybe the problem with Iraq, with that give you that even the United States has invaded Iraq, but has no influence on Iraq. Iran has more influence in Iraq than United States. And this is very significant to see that how the Americans, they lost a lot of lives, thousands of lives in Iraq, to put actually Iraq under the influence of Iran. And the United States cannot bring Iraq to be in. I think this is a very, very important message for the United States to get.
Well, you know, Radwan Ziyadeh, that's the message that the neoconservatives should be shamed by, the stupidity of Bush and Cheney and Addington and Wolfowitz and the whole horrible crowd that brought us that ridiculous war, that the only beneficiaries of the Iraq war were clearly the Iranians. I just don't know that in the real world there's any way you can shame these people, and sometimes reality doesn't even count. It's an appalling situation. I couldn't agree with you more. But there we.
I think you are right, and I think that the United States they should put more pressure on the Iraqi government, on al-Maliki government, to respect and to understand the situation in Syria, not from the sectarian perspective, rather than from democratic perspective. Iraq, they actually struggled a lot for what's going on in Iraq in the last 5 years, because Syria intervened and supported a lot of terrorist groups. Now it's significant to see that the Iraqi, they supporting the Assad regime, rather than actually helping the change of the Assad regime.
So tell me, we spoke a while back, Radwan Ziyadeh, and you felt that time had run out for peaceful protest because of the brutality of the Assad clan, who claim Syria as their own private plantation, and they were continuing to murder people without any compunction, and that you felt that inevitably it would the nonviolent struggle would move to armed struggle. Where do we stand now? There have been some attacks on the secret police. That the Air Force, of course, are you know where the secret police come out of. There was apparently six pilots were killed. Syrian elite pilots were killed as well. What's your understanding of where things stand in terms of army defectors?
Now there is a lot of defection among the army and those who are actually responsible on attacking the Assad militias. But that doesn't mean that the overwhelming of the protests is still peaceful and that the nature of the Syrian uprising is still peaceful. But we need actually the international community to intervene to protect the peacefully of the Syrian uprising. Because as soon the international community, it has to intervene to prevent Syria from the civil war. Because if the international community is not intervening quickly, more possibility to have civil war, then the international community will intervene to manage the civil war. It's much better to intervene right now to prevent the civil war rather than managing the civil war later.
So tell me then, Radwan Ziyadeh, what would this intervention look like? I mean, we've already discussed the reluctance of China and Russia to endorse any UN action because they feel they got burned on Libya. Assuming that Russia and China would not veto any resolution, what kind of UN resolution would you want to stop the bloodshed in Syria?
It's clear to put sanctions on Bashar al-Assad, refer the crimes against humanity to the International Criminal Court, and to create a safe zone or a buffer zone along with the Turkish and Syrian border, and this has to be protected and imposed by no-fly zone. This is the way that the international community, they can help and they can protect the civilian, because the Assad regime will not stop the killing, as I told you before, in any way without having all the necessary measures by the Security Council.
So which member states do you think would be able to... Turkey's playing a very helpful role so far. If there was an authorization from the UN, what kind of an international force do you think could be put together?
I think the international community has... To work together. And of course, France, Turkey, and United States, and other European countries, along with the Arab League, all of them, they are on the same page right now to take actions to protect the civilians in Syria. And this is why Turkey, along with the, since Turkey is a NATO member, can be a significant role in putting the buffer zone and imposing the no-fly zone.
So just in closing then, Radwan Ziyadeh, I know that you've been working with the Syrian opposition, and you are, of course, with the secretary of the Syrian Organization for Transparency, and you founded and directed the Syrian Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C., along with the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies. What would your final comment be on whether or not this is possible? I mean, I know you're working to make this possible, to stop the bloodshed. You don't believe that anything will stop Assad, because clearly the fact that he wouldn't let the Arab League monitors in indicates that he doesn't want anybody to know what he's doing, and he wants to continue doing it until he can kill enough people that everybody will stop protesting this regime that clearly that people want to get rid of. So just in closing, what kind of chances do you think of what you're calling for being implemented?
I am a member of the Syrian National Council, which is the main umbrella of the Syrian opposition, and also I'm the head of the Foreign Relations Office. Our official position at the Syrian National Council to protect the civilians, and this is our responsibility to protect our own people. And this is why it cannot, this is done without having safe zone and no-fly zone. This is all the necessary measures should be the international community work on it to stop the bloodshed in Damascus and in Syria.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Radwan Ziyadeh.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Radwan Ziyadeh, who's the founder and director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies. He's a visiting scholar at the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University and a visiting fellow at Chatham House, the Royal Institute for International Affairs in London. And as he just pointed out, he is with the Syrian Opposition Council and head of their Foreign Affairs Division. So he's playing an active role in trying to stop the bloodshed in his country at the hands of this brutal family, this clan of dictators who see this country as their own private plantation and will kill as many people as necessary in order to hold on. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the tensions on the border with Pakistan and Afghanistan following a NATO raid that killed 24 Pakistani soldiers. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, who was a former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the United States Department of State from 1991 to 2003, and is an emeritus professor at the University of Illinois, where he directs the program in South Asian and Middle East Studies. Dr. Weinbaum was a senior fellow at the United States Institute for Peace and held Fulbright Research Fellowships for Afghanistan and Egypt. He's authored numerous books, including The Future of Afghanistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Marvin Weinbaum.
You're very welcome.
And clearly, this NATO strike that killed 24 Pakistani troops has this is you know, salt in the rubbing salt in the wound between this prickly relationship. My understanding was that U.S. The anti-Americanism in Pakistan was an all-time high prior to this. So what's your understanding of how the Pakistani people are reacting to this?
Well, our standing with the Pakistani people can't get much lower. It is probably in the single digits. So there's really nowhere for it to drop to. But what it does mean is that this incident, following on the heels of several others during the course of this year, is going to make it just that much harder to get back to a working relationship with Pakistan, which is vital for the interests of both countries.
So they can't divorce, but they can what? Sort of sit in corners and seethe at each other? I mean, give me a picture of where this relationship is going.
Well, you know, we don't even know if it's hit bottom. Every time we think we've seen the bottom, we find that, no, it's not there yet. But each time it also, you know, becomes that much harder to find those common denominators on which we can agree. One thing is clear, that we don't have some of the illusions that we had earlier about trust and forming a strategic partnership. Now it's all about you give us this, and we'll give you that. This is important for us because what we're talking about here is our concern with what happens in the next 3 years in Afghanistan, our ability to supply our troops through Pakistani land routes from the port of Karachi to two particular portals into Afghanistan in Pakistan. And we're going to need that. We have 50% dependency on that route. That can't be replaced. So our safe withdrawal from Afghanistan and the pursuit of our objectives there for the time being really are dependent. And then the other thing we need to do is to be able to take it to the enemy. And that's what we've used the drones. Well, they've not only cut off for the time being our supply route, blocked it, but they have they've asked us to remove what few troops we had left in one of their air bases. Actually, we can do without that, but it nevertheless may imply that we're going to have less in the way of intelligence sharing, and that could hurt us.
So, Dr. Marvin Weinberg, you're talking about how the Pakistanis have told the United States to vacate within 15 days the Shamsi Air Base.
That's correct.
I thought that they'd already gotten out of there.
Well, we had really moved most of our people out of there. There's just apparently a few left there now. So that's not really any kind of concession that we've made. We're able to operate the drones out in Afghanistan. But what we do need is we need intelligence sharing on the ground to be able to target. Some of this we can do just with surveillance, but there's nothing better than having the kind of intelligence that identifies where someone's going to be at a particular point in time, for example. That could be a real casualty here. Another casualty of all this is the impact on Pakistan. I say that our standing is pretty low, but it's as much as giving we've given a gift to the extremist groups who will, you know, go running with this now, and they're likely to gain even more adherence as they bring home their case that we're our natural enemies of Pakistan, not partners. And eventually this can threaten the stability of the country.
Well, clearly the drones and this NATO attack are symptoms of a problem here that we don't have good intelligence. We have a strategy based upon our overwhelming air power, but it not necessarily applied in a way that does anything except have blowback. We have a history here going back to September of 2010, when NATO helicopters killed two Pakistani soldiers. That created a two-week closure of the border.
Right.
And then you've got in April of this year, there was a protest over the drones, again, where the borders were closed for three days. And then he had the killing of bin Laden, which, and then Admiral Mike Mullins cut troops in Pakistan in June, and then the U.S. suspended in July $800 million in military aid. And then, in, of course, in September of this year, outgoing chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mullen, said that Pakistan was supporting the Haqqani Network, which is a virtual asset of Pakistani military.
That's quite a litany of thrusts at the relationship. And but I would take issue with the fact that the drones haven't accomplished very much. Actually, they have. They not only have some high-value targets been taken out. Unfortunately, there's been innocent people along the way, but not nearly as many as some of the groups may claim. But it has disrupted some of the activities of the insurgents coming into Afghanistan. And it's hard to calculate just how important that is, but it is more difficult for them to operate on the Pakistan side. We need it because of the absence of the kind of pressure that we'd like to see from the Pakistan military on those elements like the Haqqani group and Al-Qaeda. So we are left with a weapon which indeed it can be counterproductive, but at the same time, it's about all we have. And on balance, considering that we've already lost the population support in any event, there's probably an argument to be made, I think there is, for continuing the use of drones. Without that, we really have our hands tied as far as what's going on over across the border.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, who is the former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the United States Department of State. But already, Dr. Weinbaum, Afghanistan has become an election issue. The Republican candidates have had a couple of national security debates where Afghanistan came up, and essentially the Obama has been accused of all kinds of things, but cutting and running is it will be of course the latest one. It does seem that given the budget constraints and the need to cut the defense budget, already we're counting the withdrawal from Iraq as cost savings, even though the war itself wasn't on the books any rate. And I take it that there's a tremendous investment in getting out. I don't think there's any doubt, is there, that the administration wants to get out?
Oh, yes. We're committed, along with our allies, to a complete drawdown of military forces by the end of 2014. I don't think it can become a campaign issue for the simple reason that, you know, it's a good line to say cut and run. Nobody really finds that attractive behavior. But the fact is that the American public at this point in time doesn't support the war. And so Obama's withdrawal of forces now first from Iraq and as I say, in 3 years from Afghanistan is generally approved by the American public. Therefore, I just don't believe that's going to have much traction as a campaign issue, certainly not when the economy seems to be overriding everything else.
Well, clearly, though, all along, you know, we've talked about how this prickly relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan has had its not so much its ups and downs, but its downs and further downs. And now this one is really caused a kind of tremendous anger with the Army Chief General Ashraf Pervez Kayani leading the mourners in the funerals for these soldiers.
Yes.
I think that's a fairly significant statement.
Well, this is a real blow to them. The military takes pride, obviously, in its forces, and the public takes pride in the military. And civilian casualties are going to be noted and so on. But when their armed forces, and a fair number of people killed in the attack, that's a particularly hard blow for them. Like the the raid on the bin Laden compound in Abbottabad in May, because it goes to the very question about whether the military can defend itself and whether it's there to whether it really deserves people's adulation as it has been getting, particularly lately.
Well, but all along, Pakistan has been ambivalent, to say the least, about what we're doing in Afghanistan. And there's no question, I think, that they do shelter the Haqqani network. That's considered some kind of asset on the part of the ISI. We've also got the Quetta Shura there in Pakistan with Mullah Omar. I think it's obvious that Pakistan is hedging its bets and wants to influence a post-NATO Afghanistan. So why don't we just accept that and get
it? Well, because, first of all, not only would it be unacceptable to us, because it would mean that we would see a resurrection of the Taliban regime, which it may in the long run be what happens.
Well, because what we've put together doesn't work, right?
If it doesn't work, that's right. Mm-hmm. But let's face it, that the consequences of that kind of outcome are not pretty ones. We're looking at the almost certainty of a civil war, one which will bring the neighboring countries in as sponsors of their proxies in various parts of the country. There, Iran in the West, the Russians and Central Asian republics in the North. India will get involved. Saudi Arabia may get involved. This is a nightmare for Pakistan. It certainly wants to avoid that, but that's likely to be the consequence of a return of the Taliban. And we're talking here also about at least a couple of million refugees. So we've got a humanitarian crisis on our hands as well. The international community will, because Pakistan can't handle it alone. These are very serious. The effect on recruitment to terrorist organizations, I think, will be rather substantial. After all, they'll be able to crow that now they've defeated the United States just as they defeated the Soviet Union. It could have consequences for radicalization in the Gulf area, for one. But above all, it will have very likely a blowback on Pakistan itself. That is, the Pakistanis are fooling themselves if they think that the Afghans, the Afghan insurgents, are simply nationalists. They're Islamists. And their same mindset, their same set of beliefs, are like those of the Pakistani Taliban. So the fact that they have different agendas at the moment, the Pakistani Taliban, of course, trying to change the Pakistani state, and the Afghan Taliban trying to unseat the Kabul government, eventually their interests come together. And it would be, I think, rather foolish to expect that the Afghan Taliban, having taken power in Kabul, are now going to say, well, this is all we're really interested in. We don't care whether there's an Islamic government, a real Islamic government in Pakistan or not. No. So in the 90s, that insurgency in Pakistan didn't exist. but now it does. And I think that the Pakistanis are aware of this and really don't want to see a complete Taliban victory in Afghanistan. Maybe at one point they did, but they know they can't control them. And what they would like to see is a kind of political arrangement which they have orchestrated, which puts the Taliban in power in Kabul in a coalition with other forces, which they would hope would then tame it and keep it from adopting a broader agenda outside the country, a more ambitious agenda. This is really what they're aiming for. They don't really expect or want a clear Taliban victory.
Well, Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, who is a former Afghanistan and Pakistan analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the United States Department of State from 1991 to 2003. He's an emeritus professor at the University of Illinois, where he directs the program in South Asian and Middle East Studies, and was a senior fellow at the United States Institute for Peace and held Fulbright Research Fellowships for Afghanistan and Egypt, and authored a number of books, including The Future of Afghanistan. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the impending closure of the Occupy LA encampment.
Oh, I do believe if you don't like things you leave for some place you've never gone before.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us in the studio is Clark Davis, an activist and the media coordinator for Occupy LA. I will also be joined by Tom Hayden, who is the founder and director of the Peace and Justice Resource Center in Culver City. Tom Hayden's a founding member of Students for a Democratic Society and was active in the anti-war movements and went on to serve for 18 years in the California legislature. Currently, he works on projects aimed at ending the United States' current wars, stopping sweatshop labor, and protecting the environment. He's the author of The Long 60s, from 1960 to Barack Obama. And also, we're supposed to be joined here by Los Angeles Councilman Bill Rosendahl. We're just trying to get in touch with him as we speak. Welcome to Background Briefing, Clark Davis.
Thanks, Ian.
And Tom Hayden, do we have you? Tom is not on yet. Okay. So, Clark, the deadline is midnight Sunday.
12:01 a.m. Monday morning.
And it's instead of it looking like people are just going to accept this, it's looking more like a confrontation's brewing. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's really hard to tell. Obviously, we at our foundation is we are a nonviolent, peaceful movement. So we're expecting this to go down without incident, although obviously there are people there that have not necessarily been a part of the movement, that have kind of came in and kind of skimmed off the top the resources that we were offering. So it's difficult to say how they're going to behave, how they're going to react. But we've gone around and talked to pretty much anyone in the camp, everyone in the camp who's willing to listen, talking about nonviolent principles. We screened a movie last night in the square starting at 5:30 called A Force More Powerful, about six nonviolent protests of the past that have been successful. We had a fantastic attendance at that. So we're going to do everything we can to continue to work with the city to try to pull this off to the point where both we look good and the city look good. But it really remains to be seen at this point in time, I think, what's going to happen.
Well, I want to follow up on the idea of there's a group that's sort of come into your movement that may well provoke some violence. But let's bring Tom Hayden into the discussion, the former the founder and director of the Peace and Justice Resource Center in Culver City. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tom Hayden.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And as good morning to you. And just as Clark Davis has just said,
Clark,
say hello to Tom.
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Thanks for joining us.
And Clark was just suggesting there was a group that the founders of this Occupy movement don't necessarily control. So what's your reading on whether there's going to be a clash? Are we heading in that direction?
Well, I have to tell you, if I wasn't scheduled for surgery in the next couple of days, I'd be down there tonight, all night, and I urge everybody to also attend to be a show of strength. And I think the larger the group, the more difficult it is for smaller elements to kick something off or provoke something.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask Clark directly. Who are these groups? You said they came in and they've been skimming your resources. I think that's a quote.
Yeah. I mean, it's just any number of people that have come in off the streets. We set up camp there. We had fantastic intentions. We really wanted to bring the world's attention onto this movement, to the positive, role that we want to play in opening up this discussion. And, being where we were, being the fact that we had food and toilets and a safe place to sleep, any number of people kind of just showed up to participate, but not participate in a way that has led this movement in a positive direction. I think it's really weighed us down to a certain extent. It made it difficult for us to do what we came there to do, which was to literally start addressing any number of really critical issues that this country is facing, and it's been a very challenging process in many ways.
But are they freeloaders or provocateurs? I mean,
it's safe to say that they're both at this point in time. And we've done everything we can to try to bring them into the fold, to try to bring them into the discussion, to try to bring them into the GA process, which I think is a flawed process, but nonetheless, try to bring them in
GA
every way.
General Assembly.
Yeah. We just didn't have much luck. We just had a difficult time getting through to them, I believe.
So, Tom Hayden, you had a piece in the Nation recently. Who will be the un-Bloomberg? What mayors should say about Wall Street? And there was an expectation that Mayor Villaraigosa would be the exception to the rule and would come out of this looking like a good leader and a decent human being. What's your expectation now, Tom, about how it's going to?
I don't know. He hasn't followed the advice of the article. It may not be too late. I mean, the point is, we should all be alarmed that the effect of the Wall Street crisis and the budget cuts fall most heavily on cities, and that's where you have all the problems of foreclosures and cutbacks in public employment, teachers, the rest of it. And the mayors are in a position to accurately blame Wall Street for bringing about a crisis that they have to deal with existentially. Every day, cities are going broke. And I don't think that it's over yet, but the Mayor Villaraigosa is the head of the National Association or Organization of Mayors. And in that position, he's taken a very good stance against the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and called for the money to be reallocated at home. And secondly, he has taken a gutsy stance on Prop 13 and the need to revise it so that the loopholes for big downtown property owners are removed, and that would also free up money for the cities. On this one, I think it would be fairly easy for Antonio Villaraigosa and other mayors to call for the Congress to close the loopholes on Wall Street derivatives, which are the biggest loopholes in Dodd-Frank. And they don't have to ask for the encampment to have a unanimous or 90% approval of it. They just need to act. And it's my experience is that if you're if you're taking action, taking leadership, people will pay attention, will follow, will be supportive, and in time, the need for an encampment, a fixed encampment, could decline and evaporate without the violence. But I don't know if the people in the mayor's office have a sensitivity to the dynamics of crowds and movements, and I don't know from the encampments I visited that they have that much sensitivity to the dynamics of electoral politics. So the police are left with a horrible assignment that they will carry out, when in fact the prosecutors should be prosecuting Wall Street and not have Charlie Beck and the cops go in and try to pull people out of tents. It's going to be dangerous. There's a risk of serious injury. It's going to be on television. It's going to change the subject from Wall Street to police crackdowns. I don't quite understand why this has to happen, but it has a quality of inevitability about it right now, and maybe if enough people go down there this evening and show support, it will cause the mayor to reconsider.
Well, let me ask Clark Davis here in the studio. You've your group's been in negotiations clearly with the mayor. What is your sense of the inevitability that Tom Hayden's talking about? Are the lines of communication open?
No. At this point in time, I don't think the channels of communication are open at all. We're very disappointed in the response of the mayor. We appreciate the support of the city council and the LAPD so far has been pretty fantastic, and the fire department and so on and so forth. But as far as we can tell at this point in time, all channels of communication are closed. I mean, we assembled here peacefully to express our First Amendment rights, seeking redress of our grievances. For the most part, this movement has been very peaceful. And at this point in time, we feel like he's basically just shut down all communication. He talked the other day in his address, about the social injustice and the economic issues that are plaguing this country. This is why we're here. And for him to basically discontinue this discussion, to me, really makes me wonder how serious he is about these issues. This is why we're here. The city, as far as I could tell, was supporting this movement. Maybe we didn't make enough progress as necessary. He cited, public health concerns and some safety concerns. We are doing everything we can, working very closely with the health department. I was in particular. I think we had a pretty good grip on these issues. And, next thing we know, everything is off the table. And, obviously we force eviction at 12:01 this morning, Monday morning. So,
what about these offers of an alternative venue, of office space? What happened with that?
Those were incredibly vague. They were nothing to negotiate with, as far as I could tell. I went over and looked at the space that they had suggested over in the mall across the street, and it closes at 7. There's no place for us to sleep. In fact, the mayor even suggested that he was going to bring social services down today to help us transition out of the park. I've not seen any of that yet as well, too. So I think he's just been posturing. He's a political animal. I don't think he's been genuine at all with this movement and with us as a movement. But
surely, Clark, he doesn't want to have the kind of pictures that have been on television that we've seen from UC Davis, from New York. He doesn't want to have LAPD people cracking heads and blood flowing on the steps of City Hall.
I've talked to Commander Sherman, Commander Smith, any of the other LAPD officers, I think, that have been fantastic. I know, based on our action that I helped kind of spearhead at B of A Plaza, that they intend to do this as peacefully as possible to arrest the people that want to stay behind. And we're hoping that this does indeed go off very peacefully. It remains to be seen. We are definitely calling for Los Angelinos to show up today in mass to show support for this movement, even though there's been some, there's been some negative press on us. Ultimately, there's a lot of people there who are really trying to do incredibly positive things. And we want people to come down and show support for the movement, which is going to throw the police off, I think, a little bit. So hopefully that'll happen.
And Tom Hayden, what's your sense of the idea of a permanent space and the idea that that the city has an obligation, that the city has an obligation, the state perhaps too, to homeless people? There have been some arguments now that the resources devoted to Occupy LA have somehow been at the expense of the homeless situation. I don't see a lot of examples of compassion.
No evidence of that. Yeah. As I said, I think the mayor has given the protesters no choice but to stand and nonviolently resist, because otherwise it's a victory for him and a defeat for the protest. That's the problem. And didn't have to come to this point in my judgment, but it's coming to that point. As for alternative sites, that's a tricky question. It seems to me that the encampment creates a very powerful message of shame on you to city administrators and downtown financial districts around the country. You can't go into our city hall without walking through the tents. And that sign of shame is very strong, and I think that the Downtown Business Association, Central City Association, and maybe some of the banks want that gone. They want that symbol of shaming them gone, and that's their objective. And it could also be combined with a motive on the part of the mayor that I'm only speculating that it has to do with who's the boss here. You know, if the mayor can't enforce an eviction, then he suffers a reputational setback, and he's not thinking of what the reputational consequences might be, and I stress might, if things go badly later today. As for moving, yeah, they could move to Fletcher Bowden Square if the mayor is worried about the grass. It's just a kitty corner, but they'd have to have permission to encamp, 24-hour opportunity to encamp. I don't see that in the LA. I haven't been part of the discussions. I've talked to some members of the city council, but I don't see that offer there. This is a movement, not an office, and you just can't move a movement into an office. And they're not really talking about the First Amendment right, as I understand the court cases, for an encampment or any protest to be in the line of sight of the center of power that they're protesting.
Tom, we're down to the last couple of minutes. Clark, what's your sense of where this is heading? If you do get evicted, what do you do? How do you regroup? And what should that?
You know, there's many options on the table. We're discussing any number of things right now amongst us. I think it's too early to tell exactly what it's going to look like and how it's going to happen. Obviously, none of us are going to quit. None of us are going to surrender. We're all here because we think this country is deeply flawed at many different levels, and we're not just going to give up and walk away. So, I think this what's happening here today, this evening, is a part of a bigger movement afoot in this country to quash this movement, because it's really starting to bring attention to the inequities that exist in this country. I think it's obvious at this point in time that the forces at B want to keep the status quo. They don't want radical change in this country, because radical change suggests something positive at this point in time. And I see it as a race to the bottom. We're trying to address these issues, bring our voice back, our vote back, and bring some sort of sanity back to this country. And that's why we're here. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're being shut down, because sanity isn't the key word of the day in this country at this point in time.
Just a last word from you, Tom, about the very much needed educational process that these protests bring in terms of the inequities in this country.
Well, that's obvious. And the discussion about the inequities triggered by the Occupy movement will go on. But more to the immediate point, I hope that the listeners have heard in what Clark has said here the urgency and the morality of the appeal for sanity in Los Angeles and will be supportive of the continuation of the protests and opposed to a forcible eviction.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today. Tom Hayden,
thank you.
Again, the founder and director of the Peace and Justice Resource Center in Culver City, founding member of Students for a Democratic Society, was active in the anti-war movement and went on to serve for 18 years in the California legislature. And joining us in the studio is Clark Davis, an activist and the media coordinator for Occupy Los Angeles. This has been, oh, by the way, Councilman Bill Rosendahl, apparently he's been addressing the Occupy protesters as we speak. That's why he didn't join us. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began speaking with a very important member of the Syrian opposition, Radwan Ziadeh, who is in touch with what is becoming an armed struggle now in Syria against the Assad regime, who the Arab League just not recently ejected, and now on top of that they've imposed sanctions. The key to whether anything will be done, obviously the sanctions were imposed because Assad wouldn't let 4,000 Arab League monitors in to witness the slaughter that's going on. That seems to be the bottom line there. And this Radwan Ziadeh basically said that the only hope to save his own people from being slaughtered is for the UN to step up and create safe havens in Turkey, and not necessarily to arm the opposition, but to protect the Syrian people with a no-fly zone in the north, with Turkey being a NATO member. That wouldn't be hard to implement, but clearly Russia and China are not on board. Then I spoke about the latest source of tension between the US and Pakistan following the NATO airstrike that killed 24 Pakistani soldiers. This is a kind of a marriage of inconvenience between these erstwhile allies that they can't seem to get divorced from. So it's hard to know whether this relationship can bottom out anymore. But at the end of the day, he admitted, even though he did defend the drone program as being the only thing that works, at the end of the day, nothing's going to work, that the U.S. has to get out, and that the U.S. is committed to getting out, and that Pakistan will be the main player in there, and that they will probably descend into a civil war from which, at the end of the day, is probably the only thing that will stop Pakistan from just letting the Taliban have its way, since they're a proxy, will be the fact that eventually the Pakistan Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, could get together, and that would be the end of the beginning of the end of the Pakistani state. Then we spoke to the media coordinator at Occupy LA, Clark Davis. He joined us in the studio along with Tom Hayden, founder of SDS, and talked about the impending eviction Sunday night of Occupy LA. And it's a pretty sad state of affairs, and very passionate discussion on the part of Clark Davis, who really hoped that the Occupy movement would turn into something more than a brawl between the cops and the occupiers. And again, this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.